From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The Indian Ocean tsunami has grabbed the hearts and attention of the world. Our guest tonight, Richard Posner, says the disaster is just a small taste of what man and nature could dish out. He's focused on mega catastrophes. It's time to run the numbers, he says, to consider the risks of much bigger blows and take steps to avoid them. Tonight on Point, preparing for mega catastrophes. But first tonight, we begin in Asia, where the tsunami crisis is now entering its fourth week. Up to $6 billion has been pledged to the relief effort. Although food, medicine, clothing, and soldiers are pouring into some devastated areas, in others, aid is slow in coming and poorly coordinated. Today was the first day of a five-day UN meeting in Japan to discuss how to better prepare for natural disasters. Joining me now for the latest on the relief efforts is John Bussey, Deputy Managing Editor for The Wall Street Journal, who's been covering the story in Phuket, Thailand. John Bussey, thanks for being with us tonight.
Pleasure.
Also with us tonight, Kozum Merchant, Mumbai correspondent for the Financial Times. He has been following the relief effort in India. Kozum Merchant, thank you for joining us. We've got a little delay in the line there. I hope we get Kozum Merchant with us. John Bussey, to you first, if I may. It was only a few weeks ago that Jan Egeland, the UN's point man for humanitarian affairs, was talking about stinginess. Today, he's calling the outpouring of aid for the Indian Ocean tsunami an extraordinary effort, probably unique in the history of humankind. Is that evident as you tour destruction sites?
Yeah, you know, I think that it is. And, of course, the destruction sites are quite different from country to country. In Phuket, where I was for about a week and a half, you see a fairly good infrastructure that already existed from the Thais. And while the destruction was quite bad along the coastline and something on the order of more than 5,000 people were killed, the Thais responded very quickly, and you begin to see the effectiveness of a bureaucracy that kind of reaches deep into the society. The roads people were out, the fisheries people were out, and you had body collection and sanitation put into force very quickly. Aceh is quite different, of course, where the destruction was much more broad. But there, too, I think that you can say that the aid effort so far, at least, has been successful in that there has not been the terrible cholera outbreaks that a lot of UN officials and health officials had worried about.
John, where do things stand at this point in terms of the dead? There were so many. For day after day, we saw the search for bodies and the effort to deal with those bodies. Are those by now buried, cremated, shipped home, or are there still piles of unclaimed, undealt with human remains?
In Thailand, it's much more organized, and you could probably assume that most of the bodies have been collected. They are now deep into the process of identifying them, in some cases with very sophisticated techniques, DNA analysis. Aceh, again, quite different. This is a province that has been has a brutal effort to separate from the government. The government is not as deep into this region as it is into other parts of Indonesia, and so you're still encountering villages, entire villages that were wiped out by the tsunami that were so far down the coastline the government simply had not been able to do a proper census.
I think we've lost Kozum Merchant in India. Of course, the perimeter of coastline that the tsunami hit was very widespread, right over to India and Sri Lanka, even on to Africa. In Thailand, where you were, was there evidence of the enormous international aid effort? You talked about the local bureaucracy coming out and being fairly effective. Did you see the global effort on the ground there as well?
Yes, very much so. At the kind of central mortuary of a couple of hours north of Phuket, you had various groups from Austria, from France, from Germany that were part of the victim identification process. That is, these are the guys who came in with the X-ray equipment and the DNA testing to augment the operations of the Thais. So, yes, you saw that very much there. And frankly, Thailand proved to be something of a staging operation, a staging base for the U.S. military in the rest of the region. They worked out of an old air base that they had used during the Vietnam War to fly relief into Aceh in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why, again, you saw such a rapid response, hundreds of helicopter trips into these outlying villages in Aceh that helped forestall disease outbreak and starvation.
Phuket and other Thai islands are tremendous tourist draws, especially from Europe. We saw during the disaster, you've just come back from there. Has that stream of tourists resumed, or is that industry, has it been gutted by the destruction? Did you have people sunbathing as others were dealing with disaster?
Well, you're putting your finger right on the issue as far as Thailand is concerned. Thailand is saying, you know, we don't need aid any longer. What we need is your tourists. And you do not see the return of tourists to Phuket, which, as you point out, is a famously important source of revenue for Thailand. Even worse, up the coast in Khao Lak, about 2 hours' drive north, the infrastructure along the coastline really has been seriously damaged. It'll be quite some time before they've rebuilt some of those resorts. These areas catered to Europeans. I think Europeans are a little bit hesitant about going back to a place where there has been so much death and where they probably, you know, the 6 degrees of separation, they most likely know of somebody who was there during the disaster. Mm-hmm. It'll be quite some time before that mood changes, I think.
And John Bussey, finally, I wonder if you have a sense of how Asians or the Thais that you were dealing with, how they're thinking about this catastrophe. What kind of context do they put it in? This is a difficult sort of thing for humans to grapple with intellectually, something that may come only once a century or even less frequently than that. How are they looking at their relationship with nature and with the odds of disaster returning?
I think that there's a sort of a variance. From the scientists, they say it happens only once every several hundred years. To the people living on the coastline who have no choice but to live there, the fishing villages, for example, in Thailand, they say we simply have to get back out on the water. Please help us repair our ships. Those people who have an option, I was talking to some shopkeepers in Phuket who were a couple of hundred yards in from the beach, and the water roared down and stopped short of their shops. Some of them, if they can, if they have the option, are thinking of taking other jobs further inland. But that's very often not the case along certainly the coastline of Sri Lanka and the coastline of Aceh. These people simply do not have options. So right now what they're concerned with most is the day-to-day subsistence. From a religious standpoint and a spiritual standpoint, they're quite keen on getting the spirits that have of the people who have died on to the afterlife. There's a great sense of haunting by ghosts in Thailand. It's a kind of a Buddhist and an animist environment. And then they need to get back down to sort of the day-to-day life. And for people in Phuket, that means a reliance on foreign dollars coming in as tourists.
Spiritual work to be done and jobs to be done. John Bussey, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
You bet.
John Bussey, Deputy Managing Editor of the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Hong Kong. He's just back from Phuket, Thailand. Richard Posner begins his new book, Catastrophe, Risk and Response, by depicting a succession of staggering worst-case scenarios. A deadly disease pandemic, an asteroid colliding with the Earth, lethal bioterrorism, nanomachines munching up the planet. The U.S. Court of Appeals judge warns that science fiction, where catastrophe risks often loom without biting, lulls us into not appreciating the true magnitude of the potential threats we face. Posner says, let's run the numbers, assess the actual risk, and then respond. He's open to many prevention measures, from battling asteroids in space to torturing terror suspects on Earth. Depending on your view of the universe, his call may sound urgent or over the top. Tonight on Point, Richard Posner on planning for mega catastrophes. You can join the conversation tonight between war and tsunami. Are your thoughts turning to disaster these days? Are you up for intervention or trusting in fate? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Chicago is Richard Posner. He's a judge in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. He's also a senior lecturer at the University of Chicago Law School and author of dozens of books on subjects from the law to sex to impeachment. His new book is Catastrophe, Risk and Response. Good evening and welcome, Judge Richard Posner.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to have you here.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Judge Posner.
Judge Posner, you spend your mornings hearing cases in a court of law, and apparently, recently, your afternoons, evenings, and for all I know, overnight, thinking about the most dire sort of catastrophes. You've written about so many things. You've got, 30-plus books to your name. What has turned your mind most recently to catastrophe, even mega catastrophe?
Well, I had been interested in the question of how law can deal with scientific advance, how we can understand it and cope with it. And I just happened in the thinking about that, happened to read a novel by Margaret Atwood called Oryx and Crake, which is a science fiction story about global warming and bioterrorism. And I wondered whether this was, you know, pure fiction or whether it had some realistic scientific basis. Did some research, found it did have a genuine scientific basis. So I became interested in the general issue of catastrophic risks, especially risks that are created or magnified by human activity. But of course, natural risks are important also, as we know from the tsunami. And then the question arises, well, can we use science and various analytical methods and sometimes law to deal with some of these problems?
Asia was blindsided by the tsunami. You say, look, these things, if we use some math and statistics, we can run the risk. We can assess the risk more precisely. We can look at what depth of response is appropriate to try and head it off. But I think to start with, you might give us a sense of the scale of catastrophe you have in mind. As I understand it, the tsunami, which affected countries all the way from Indonesia to the coast of Africa, doesn't even really meet the scale of catastrophe you're talking about. It looks small in your sort of big shop of horrors.
Yes, because I was particularly interested in the difficulty people have in thinking about and taking measures against risks that are genuine but have never materialized in the past. Now, tsunamis are familiar. There's a long history of them. So there's less excuse, in a way, to not being prepared for such a thing. And it's true, you know, well, it is an earth, is the consequence of an earthquake and volcanoes and so on. So there are a lot of catastrophic events that have occurred before, and so we can think about them. We don't always think we can, but there's also a class of events that have not occurred, at least haven't occurred in human memory, that have, you know, really enormously catastrophic consequences. In a sense, that's why they haven't occurred. If they had occurred, we mightn't be here. And I was concerned that you know, these are real dangers. And we don't seem to do anything about. Often we don't do anything about them, or we really don't try to assess them and think of what would be a cost-justified response.
We've got a break coming up. We'll come back and talk about what some of those mega catastrophes might be. But do you see yourself suggesting that humans sort of play God in trying to put these things off or avoid them?
Oh, I don't know. Sure, of course. Play God. If you can play God successfully, yeah, I couldn't do better than that. Yeah, no. There are certain types of kind of absurd ambitiousness, like, you know, worrying about the sun expanding into the Earth's orbit in 3 billion years. Mm-hmm. I don't worry about things like that. But catastrophes that could occur in the near future and that we could do something about, yes, of course we should think about it. Now, it might turn out that there are too many of these catastrophes, they're too costly to deal with, and we just have to chance it, just have to risk it. So that can be a perfectly rational response, but you have to think about it before you decide to close your eyes and just tough it out.
Jack Beatty, Richard Posner saying, eyes wide open, folks. There are enormous risks out there. Let's assess them and stand up to them.
Well, you know, I think people are much more receptive to this outlook and this general viewpoint than they were before this tsunami. I mean, suddenly the fragility of the planet was borne home to us, and the $1 billion expense as well. So Judge, I think you may have hit a wave here of public interest.
A propitious moment. We're talking tonight about mega catastrophes, asteroids, plague, nuclear winter, and how humans should, could prepare for them. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about mega catastrophes. We're thinking about the unthinkable with Judge Richard Posner. His new book is Catastrophe, Risk and Response. You can join the conversation tonight. Between war and tsunami, are your thoughts turning to disaster lately? Are you prepared to set aside tax dollars to guard against the unthinkable, a world-killing asteroid hit, the collapse of the Earth into strange matter? Should we take out insurance against mega catastrophe, or is that best left in the hands of God, of fate? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Richard Posner, judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, joins us from Chicago. And Richard Posner, I wish you'd describe and make real to us some of the threats you're talking about here. They are by nature difficult to fathom. I wish you'd sort of lay out the buffet of horrors that's caught your attention.
The simplest one to understand, especially because it links up with a tsunami, would be an asteroid collision. So scientists believe that 65 million years ago, an asteroid, a fairly modest size, maybe 6 miles in diameter, hit what is now a part of Mexico and caused enormous damage through shock waves, fire, rapid global warming, blotting out photosynthesis because of debris in the air and so on, that led to the extinction of the dinosaurs along with, I think, a third, maybe two-thirds, I don't remember now, of mammal species. So you know, that could happen again. That would be unusual, asteroid collision of that size. Obviously, it's happened. Apparently, it's happened several times in the history of the Earth, but scientists think of it as a 1 in 70 million to 1 in 100 million chance. So that's very small.
So there's a straight-up natural catastrophe.
But on the other hand, a much smaller asteroid collision, also much more likely, could be catastrophic. So, for example, in 1908, an asteroid, a tiny asteroid, about 200 feet across, exploded above Siberia, and exploded with the force of a hydrogen bomb. Now, if that exploded above a city, of course, it could kill millions of people. So that happened less than a century ago. So that sort of thing.
And you've got a raft of approaches for addressing these, but take us on through your list here. That falls in your category of natural catastrophes. You also talk
about... Well, there are others, of course, you know, like flu. People worry. The flu epidemic in 1918-1919 killed between 20 and 40 million people. Well, that could happen again. But yes, there are these. Then you move from the natural epidemic to the terrorist epidemic, and what people are particularly worried about is smallpox. Now, smallpox, the only smallpox virus that is supposed to exist, is locked up in laboratories in the United States and Russia. Mm. But just the other day, there was an article in Times referring to an article in Nature about the progress that scientists are making in synthesizing biological units, including viruses,
potentially
and
pathogens.
In fact, they had previously synthesized the polio virus. Now it looks as if it is possible and perhaps rather easy to synthesize the smallpox virus.
So you're talking there about bioterrorism. You put it in the category of intentional catastrophes. That could include nuclear terrorism, bioterrorism, nuclear winter brought on by an attack.
Yes, but bioterrorism is the most ominous because it requires the least engineering and scientific sophistication, and also, you know, a nuclear bomb, if it be obviously serious, depending on where it was set off, but it's not contagious, so to speak. Whereas a disease like smallpox starts off with ambiguous symptoms. There's a in what's called infectious incubation period, when you have no symptoms, but you're actually
walking around for a month.
You're walking
right.
around effectively. So there's no cure for smallpox, and if the and the synthetic smallpox or smallpox that had been altered with biotechnology might be immune to viruses, so to vaccines. So there'd be no vaccine, no cure. Has about a 30% mortality rate. So the scale of a disaster, when you consider the panic that five anthrax deaths did in October, caused in October 2001, you can mm-hmm. see the magnitude.
You talk about catastrophic accidents that might be caused by unfettered scientific exploration, including one that turned my head. I hadn't heard of it, but the potential for a particle accelerator to spin off high-density quarks that would collapse, compress the Earth into like 100 by 100 meter, I don't know, cold, dead thing in a matter of seconds.
Dense sphere, yeah. Yeah, well, this is speculative and presumably unlikely, but there is respectable scientific concern about advanced particle accelerators in which massive nuclei of gold, which has, you know, almost 300 protons and neutrons, are collided with each other at, you know, very, very high speeds and throw off a shower of quarks. And there's a theoretical possibility that if these quarks were what are called strange quarks, which are extremely dense, they could clump and they could attract surrounding matter, and the clump would grow, and within, you know, a fraction of a second, the whole Earth would be this dense, strange matter, would be this tiny sphere that you mentioned, and it would blow up. So that would be the end of everything. So again, very low probability, but the important thing there is that we're spending, because you mentioned, you know, should the taxpayer be paying higher taxes to deal with some of these things? Well, we're already spending $750 million a year to support particle research. So if we slow down our particle accelerator programs, it wouldn't cost the taxpayer anything. In fact, it would save the taxpayer money.
Just take a chunk out of that spending
just
and put it towards security and safety for these.
Well, or just do less of these experiments, of the dangerous experiments.
And to similarly, change the risk profile.
Similarly, with the asteroids, so NASA, which has a budget of more than $10 billion a year, spends only $4 million on trying to map the asteroids that are in dangerous proximity to the Earth.
And then you've got the unintended products of technological progress.
The point I want to stress is that NASA could, or Congress could, divert some of NASA's budget from manned space travel and other sort of extravagances to more rapid mapping of the sky to make sure we identify the dangerous asteroids. So it's not necessarily a matter of increasing taxpayer burdens to deal with some of these problems.
And I just want to point out this final category, for example, abrupt climate change, byproducts of technological process, global warming, climate change, and a mega catastrophe on that scale. I'm sure that as listeners hear this list, some of these familiar potential catastrophes, some entirely unfamiliar, they must be scratching their heads and saying, is this realism or is this paranoia? How do you look at that, Richard Posner?
No, it's real. I'm not paranoid. You know, I'm not worried about Martians landing or anything like that. No, these are all problems that have been addressed by scientists and who have expressed concern. As you put it at the beginning, if there's nothing we can do about these things, then all right, forget about it, just live with it. But even though, I mean, what we learned with the tsunami, you can have a very low probability event, but nevertheless, low probability events do occasionally occur. When they occur, they can have enormous consequences, and there are loads of these possibilities. So the ones we can deal with at reasonable cost or maybe at no cost, you know, as in the two examples I gave, we should at least think about it. We shouldn't just dismiss it all as fate. you know, your reference to God and faith and so on, maybe you think or someone thinks that a benevolent providence is going to protect us from these mega catastrophes, but I wouldn't gamble on that.
Protect us or not. Fate could go either way. Jack Beatty, I find myself receiving this, you know, somewhere in between my pragmatism sensors and my philosophical sensors, and I'm not sure how to process what Richard Posner is giving us here.
Well, I just hope no one gives this book to Dick Cheney. He's already so gloomy and so full of Hobbesian scenarios.
He'll never come out of the bunker again?
He won't come out of
that bunker. Won't show for the inaugural?
He'll stay there for the whole administration. But, you know, I mean, this is rationality, right? Let's think about the future and to actually use what is a modern science of statistics and cost-benefit analysis and projection to weigh risks that we can now conceptualize.
Absolutely.
And you know, the ingredients that you're worried about, I mean, one of the things we should be worried about in this world is dangerous knowledge. There is such a thing.
Yes.
The old Faustian bargain is someday you have to pay the piper on it.
We've got the bomb and someone else may too.
That's it. That was dangerous knowledge, and there's other of it out there. But, you know, it's when you look at how people in real time in history respond to foreseeable crisis, that's where you really kind of despair. I mean, just to give a bipartisan example, I mean, Condoleezza Rice today, well, you look at the 9/11 Commission, you read Richard Clark's book, again and again, he's trying to get her attention to this problem.
Raising the alarm,
imminent problem. Can we have a meeting? Well, we'll do a meeting later. Her whole framework is the problems of the world come from nations, this non-state actors, that's not serious. So she shrugs it off. We knew terrorism was out there, just couldn't focus on it. Oh, look at the Clinton-Gore administration. Gore writes a book saying that global warming is the moral equivalent of the war against fascism. We have to stop this for the sake of the future. Earth is in the balance. And look what they do. They try to pass a BTU tax in their first months, and they make the House vote for it. And then when the senators object, they pull the tax. And instead of even raising the mileage standards, you'd think they would have done that. They were the same since 1975. They left those alone.
So
Gore knew about this huge problem. Mm-hmm. His whole book was about it. And they couldn't act for 8 years.
But in Richard Posner's world, he and Condi Rice might have been scanning the heavens for asteroids instead of thinking about either of those things.
Yes, that's it. And I didn't actually give enough attention to that in the book, which is that you take these things one by one, the asteroids, the global warming, the bioterrorism, the flu epidemic, and so on. And with each, you know, look at each of them, and very often you say, we should focus on this. There are things we can do. But you're quite right to raise this question. As the list grows, it becomes impossible to deal with all of them. And so what happens is people make a priority list, and the things that they really just can focus on a few things at the top, and the lower down ones get dismissed completely. And of course, those may be the ones that occur. So I think your point is very good. Yeah, if they had been scanning the skies for asteroids, they might have pushed the terrorism problem even lower on there. Priority list.
But so you ignore the quark, and the next thing you know, the Earth is the size of a school bus. You've got us all in a tizzy here, Richard Posner. Let's let our callers in here. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Ida is calling from Hillsborough, North Carolina. Hi, Ida.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I think it's unbelievably arrogant to think that we as humans ought to be controlling things like natural disasters. I think the two greatest problems that we face as a species on this planet are arrogance and fear. And this book, as far as I can tell from what I'm hearing, does nothing but raise both. It's Chicken Little. The sky is falling. The sky is falling. We have so many things to work on in terms of not stopping trashing this planet and taking care of the people that are on it. Why do we want to cry, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. Isn't that the last thing we need?
Ida, we've got it. Richard Posner, how about it? Do you stand at the apex of arrogance and fear?
That doesn't make any sense. Now, look, you say you want to take care of the people, on the planet. Fine, but one way to take care of them, of course, is to protect them against being wiped out in a plague, right? So, I mean, you wouldn't say developing vaccines is, arrogant. Is that arrogant, developing vaccines? Why is developing vaccines arrogant? So if you worry about bioterrorism and you want to place some kind of controls over laboratories, some kind of international inspection system, or if you just want to expand our vaccine program so that if we suffer some kind of bioterrorist attack, we will have the vaccines, and we'll have them stocked, and we'll be able to distribute them. I think that's taking care of people, right? Avoiding their destruction. That's taking care of them, in my opinion.
Let's talk about the ways in which you would do that. I guess when it comes to asteroids, you've got to – what do? You launch some kind of nuclear explosive out there to deflect an asteroid. But closer to home, you're favoring, especially for a federal judge, some pretty draconian measures. You give a green light to torture if necessary.
No, I don't give a green light to torture. Come on. That's not true.
Oh, I guess I read it that way.
No. Look, what I say, and I'm happy to repeat, is that when we talk about civil liberties, we're always talking about civil liberties in relation to safety concerns. And what I say is that the more people feel endangered, the more people are endangered, the more they're going to look critically on the existing system of civil liberties. Now, one of these civil liberties has to do with what is permitted in interrogation. You know, how can you use the third degree, shine lights in people's eyes? Can you lie to them and so on?
We've seen a much worse, of course, lately.
Yeah, but look, I mean, the sort of standard example people give to show that no one is actually, takes kind of absolute position on this, suppose you have some criminal and he's kidnapped a child, and he's hidden the child somewhere. And you ask, and he's arrested, and you ask him, where's the child? And he says, well, I've buried her in a, coffin, and she's going to run out of air in an hour. So you say, well, where is she? We want to release her. And he says, I'm not telling you. So the policeman punches him in the face. That's actually happened, to make him talk. Hey, you think that's wrong? You think that's a violation of civil rights, civil liberties? What do you think?
Well, I think it's an open
door.
You don't know.
If you say you don't know, then I think you're in a different planet.
Well, I would look on at Abu Ghraib and the rest and say it's an open door.
I'm not asking you about it. I'm not talking about Abu Ghraib.
Yes, I am. The country's just seen it.
Abu Ghraib was wrong because there was no reason to do that. I'm giving
a concrete
example.
Can you say that from the perspective of the Marines in Iraq? I'm not so sure
that you can.
Richard Posner, we've got to take a short break here, Judge. I'm afraid the clock is going to be the dictator here. Richard Posner is with us. His new book is Catastrophe, Risk and Response. You can join the conversation, should we clamp down on foreigners starting in U.S. universities, get tough with folks with plague or nuclear winter at their fingertips. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about mega catastrophes, asteroids, plagues, nuclear winter, and how humans could prepare for them. Our guest is Richard Posner. He's a judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in Chicago. His new book is Catastrophe, Risk and Response. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you ready to apply cost-benefit analysis to the apocalypse and act on that analysis? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Judge Posner, we had to cut you off for the break there, but you're saying there are circumstances where you've got to be tough.
Sure. Yeah. Well, as I say, my example is if a policeman punches someone in the nose in order to save a kidnapped victim. Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
And if the potential risk is global plague, then how severely would you have law enforcement authorities going to deflect that?
Well, very, very far. I don't know what police measures are going to be very, very effective with that. It seems to me when we're talking about the bioterrorism problem, we don't need at the moment police measures. We need inspection measures. I don't understand why we have you know, there's an International Atomic Energy Agency, mm-hmm, and it's criticized and so on. But you know, it's an important thing to have. They try their best to limit nuclear proliferation. We don't have any corresponding body for biological research, and we should, because these poor countries, you know, often they don't have very good security, but they're very interested in biotech because they want to improve their crop yields. But the technology that's used to improve crops is also usable for creating, you know, lethal pathogens. So it seems to me there ought to be some international inspection regime, which we do not have. So that, I think, is very important. The other thing is very important in light of, you know, this. I just read Senator Lieberman wants to have a tsunami warning system, mm-hmm, for the United States.
A bigger one,
but
a better
one.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We don't have a warning system for a biological or nuclear attacks on the United States, and we should, because, you know, with a tsunami, you can't prevent it, but you can mitigate the damage it causes if people are prepared and know the signs and know what to do. Well, similarly with, you know, biological other forms of attack. So we're not doing that.
But there's been talk about it, about scans out at sea before cargo ships come in. Jack Beatty, we've talked here about risk. Richard Posner's talking a bit now about response. And, of course, when you're talking about catastrophe, you can justify quite an extraordinary response. How do you feel? Have we come to a moment in history where we're waking up to new threats in a more informed way and have the capacity to respond to them? Should we be sort of extending the perimeter of human caution, or have we still got so much within the perimeter that we're not dealing with?
The short answer is I don't know, but isn't it interesting that Michael Crichton now has a best-selling novel about a kind of police state arising out of the global need to deal with global warming? And I think, isn't that one of the scenarios you have, Judge, that
yes,
in some ways
yes.
state sovereignty may well be in conflict with planetary needs?
Absolutely.
Really puts in front of us the notion of, do we want to survive as states or do we want to survive as a species?
But Michael Crichton's come at it from just the other angle this time. He's saying the world is too much up in arms about all these potential
threats. Well, I understand.
Threats.
Right. He thinks they're just bogus, but they could be real, and the response could be very similar. An abridgment of liberty simply to survive. I mean, the small case we see with the war on terrorism, where there has been a diminution of some liberties, and for people under torture, severe, they're not necessarily citizens, but people we have in our care, severe penalties. But imagine if that were happening sort of planet-wide. I mean, a threat to civilization itself. You could imagine state sovereignty being something we couldn't afford. So, this is thinking about the unthinkable, but it makes Herman Kahn, who wrote about this stuff in the 60s, seem like a
yes,
kid.
Civil libertarians ignore is the fact that if a modest curtailment of civil liberties prevented some serious terrorist attack, that would actually be good for civil liberties in the long run, because if there's a massive terrorist attack on the United States, that would probably be the end of civil liberties because, you know, Americans, like most people, put safety ahead of liberty. That's the way people are.
We've certainly seen that concern raised. Let me get another call here. Carl's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hi, Judge Posner. What I wanted to tell you is I've actually seen you talk about torture, and but it is one of those issues that you just cannot subject to a cost-benefit analysis because it's an issue of human dignity. And, you know, there are many things that you can subject to these sorts of economic analyses, and you do, but human dignity cannot be one of those.
What about the girl in the coffin that Judge Posner describes, Carl? What do you do about that circumstance?
Then the police officer, you know, if he starts, like, pulling out the fingernails of the prisoner,
the suspect, right?
Yeah. If the prisoner, if the police officer does that, he's demeaning his own dignity and the dignity of the person whose fingernails he's pulling out, and there's no way around that.
Judge Posner says if you don't pull out a few fingernails, you may end up losing civil liberties on a much broader scale.
I think that it's really hard for, you know, one police officer on the ground or even a president to look at a situation and say, if I, you know, don't do this, if I lose my humanity in this one situation, I'm going to be able to save civilization and be right about that every time.
Yes, but what if, I mean, the classic example people give is no longer ridiculous because apparently they can now make an atomic bomb the size of an orange. And so suppose you know that there's an atomic – someone's walking around New York City with an atomic bomb the size of an orange in his briefcase. And the only way you can find out where that person is, maybe you've arrested his accomplice, and you ask the accomplice, where's the guy with the atomic bomb? And he says, I'm not going to tell you, you know, and you can't do anything to me because I have rights. Well, does that make any sense to say that because of the concern you've expressed with human dignity – you can't put pressure on this person. You can't twist his arm.
And there it is, the judge talking, not from the bench, but talking. Carl, thanks for your call. Our time is short, Richard Posner. I want to ask you, you know, it's a fascinating book, and your analysis is a fresh one to me, and absolutely really interesting. But do you worry about, you know how human beings are. You pull them out, give them a bunch of scary stories, and they can be prompted to rational responses, but also irrational responses. They can fall into paranoia. Do you worry about that?
No. The reason I don't worry about it is that the risks that I focus on in the book are risks of that I think people systematically underweight, because they're risks of things that sort of haven't happened in human memory or haven't made an impression. Flu epidemic, you know, after World War I was a tremendous killer, but somehow it didn't really leave much traces in our memory. So I think that's the real problem. One person is talking about Chicken Little. I don't see the Chicken Little at all. I don't see people who are frightened of asteroids, frightened of this strange matter thing, frightened of global warming. I don't see that that kind of hysteria.
Jack Beattie, is your fear factor spiking up tonight? Are the quirks on your heels?
Well, you know, fear is itself a form of losing liberty, isn't it? I mean, we guard ourselves. The president said this in his address right after 9/11, that it's a conflict between freedom and fear.
But then so is ignorance a loss of freedom.
That's true. That's true. And it does worry me. I am afraid when yet more things to be afraid about are put about in the world. But on the other hand, these are real possibilities, and we should think about them.
Well, Richard Posner, you've raised a bunch of new things to put out on our scary horizon. We thank you for sharing them with us tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, very welcome, and thanks for your questions. And, Mr. Beattie, nice to hear from you.
Judge Richard Posner with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in Chicago. His new book is Catastrophe, Risk, and Response. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a look at the new Airbus Mega airplane. This is On Point. It's not a bird. It's not a plane. It's a superplane. Today in Toulouse, France, with the leaders of France, Germany, Britain, and Spain looking on, the European consortium Airbus rolled out its latest design, a mammoth double-decker airplane that can seat up to 800 passengers. Its wings alone are big enough that 70 cars could park along them, and the company's expectations for the plane's success are bigger still. Airlines have already committed to $40 billion to buying the giant jumbo jet, even though it hasn't yet left the ground. Joining me now from Washington is George Novak, an aviation researcher with the Aviation Institute at George Washington University. George Novak, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. Good evening.
So what's got everyone so excited about this airplane? Is this the Europeans making a lot of buzz to sell their giant plane, or is this really something revolutionary?
I think it's something revolutionary. It's certainly a milestone. What we have here is an aircraft that is, at least in Airbus's mind, going to change the face of aviation in the same way that the 747 did in the 1970s and the Concorde did even earlier.
What is the point of an 800-seat airplane?
Revenue, like everything else right now. I mean, what they're offering the airlines is the ability to carry a large number of passengers over a very long distance, and that should result, at least in the Airbus's argument, that should result in increased revenues at a fairly efficient rate for the air carriers.
And what kind of routes are these planes going to be traveling?
I think we'll mostly see them in the United States. We will mostly see them coming from Asia, and even in possibly in European service, but mostly I think on trans-Pacific routes.
So big long haul paths.
Definitely, the long haul paths, like from Singapore, from Taiwan, from China.
And they can make more money because they can jam more passengers on a single flight?
That's right. You can get, in the standard configuration, we expect them to have approximately 555 passengers, and that's compared to about 416 in the 747. So about 33% more passengers. That's a lot of revenue.
Jacques Chirac called the new plane a cruise ship of the skies. We're told that it looks sort of like a humpbacked 747, but with that top section, that hump stretching all the way back to the tail. Give us your description of this plane.
It's a cavernous interior. I mean, it's if you saw it, you'd look at both levels, both the first level and second level, like the current level of a 777 or a 747. A lot of space, and Airbus has offered a lot of configurations to these air carriers. They're saying things like casinos can go in, piano bars. I've even heard nurseries suggested, which I think a lot of parents would and passengers would think was a great idea.
And what about the consumer research that they put into designing the plane?
They did a wonderful job. I think Airbus on three continents set up mock-ups of the aircraft interior and asked for input from frequent flyers. One of the first things that passengers said is, we'd like our own armrest, so two armrests for every seat. And Airbus is going to try to incorporate that into every design.
That would be nice. What's it going to feel like flying on this thing? Will everybody be, after all the hubbub, be strapped in their seat, maybe with an armrest, but more or less the same, you know, leg room and space as normal that people are accustomed to? Or will people be waltzing around playing volleyball?
I think it'll depend on the class of service that you're flying in. Certainly, the opportunity is there for air carriers to put in more leg room and more width in the seats so that passengers can stretch out a little more. But with that room is reduced revenue. So it's up to each carrier to decide how they'd like to configure those interiors. And obviously, they're looking mostly at increasing their revenue. So coach is going to seem very much like it does today.
Are American airports going to be extending their runways to take this in, or they can handle it as configured?
For the most part, most of the large airports in the United States should be able to handle this, that currently handle large international flights right now. The one problem is they may have to widen some of the runways to accommodate the placement of the engines on the wings and the jetways where we go in and out of the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are two levels here for entrance, Airbus is suggesting that airports that really want to make the best use of this aircraft develop dual-level jetways to get in and out of the aircraft.
We just got 20 seconds. What about the implications for Boeing?
Boeing believes that they are going along the right path with their 787 carrier, which is smaller and longer range, and they don't think the market is quite as big as Airbus has predicted. Airbus is hoping to sell nearly 700 of these aircraft in the coming years.
Well, smaller versus Goliath. George Novak, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Good evening.
George Novak, lead research scientist at George Washington University's Aviation Institute. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.